This episode of Therapy Insiders is brought to you by WebPT, the ultimate EMR for physical therapists. Give them a call at 866-221-1870 for a free demo. Check them out on the web at webpt.com/podcast. And if you're interested in business, we talk about plenty of business on this podcast. You definitely want to check out ascend2015.com, the ultimate rehab therapy business summit. It's going to have some of the biggest, best, brightest names in the field. I'll be there. You definitely want to be there. Check it out. Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. Dr. Gene Shirakabrad here with Dr. Joe Palmer, Dr. Erson Religioso. Yes, all three of us are finally back together, the three amigos. Erson has been MIA for a few recent episodes, getting a little R&R time, well earned. But good to have you back, Urs.
It's great to be back. I prefer actually Musketeers, not Amigos.
But. Three Musketeers. I don't know. I just saw something with Steve Martin and Martin Short. And for some, it's just been stuck in my head. But I mean, that's a really funny movie. I don't know the last time you saw it, but that's a great movie.
We could do My Little Bub.
All right. It's way too early. Way too early in this podcast to start going off on tangents, sort of. But so the last few episodes that we've had.
Are you starting with new tangent rules?
No, there's no new tangent rules, just because that'll get us off on another tangent. So it's never ending, Joe. It's never ending. And well done on diverting the podcast again. So, as I was saying, the last few episodes, we've had some really, really interesting discussions, I think, between Sharon Dunn, the new president of the APTA. We've had Jamie Schreier talking business. And kind of through all this, we've really talked a lot about moving forward and innovation. And from the get-go on our podcast, I think the underlying theme or a major theme has been the DPT students, right? We talk about them a lot. They're a big audience of ours. So shout out, hashtag DPT student. And one of the most important things, obviously, with DPT students is mentorship. It's critical, it's important, and it's played a big role in all of our so far upbringing in the world of physical therapy and in business. I've been lucky enough to have some really good mentors that have helped me and guided me through a lot of endeavors. And a little quick tangent, we'll talk more business towards the end of the episode about a few really cool UpDoc media announcements that we'll make about the podcast. And I have a personal update as well that I'll like to share at the end. But coming back to mentorship, Erson, you do a lot of mentoring, right, with clinicians. Joe, you're doing mentoring at the clinic as a business owner. I mean, those are super, super important things. And we'll dive more into that. But before we do, I want to introduce our guest on this week's podcast, who is very big on mentoring as well, who does a lot of progressing in the field and in the clinical type of world. And our guest is Jeff Moore. Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us. So for our listeners that might not follow you on Twitter, which we have a lot of cool discussions on, just what are you up to, man? What's your daily grind like? And tell us a little bit why you're kind of into the whole mentoring thing.
Yeah, Gene. So I'm a full-time clinician. So my brother and I have a practice here in Iron Mountain, Kingsford area, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So I'm a full-time clinician. I'm in clinic about 45 to 50 hour treatment hours a week and teach 12 to 16 weekend courses a year. So I've got, for two different companies, I have my own company. It's called the Institute of Clinical Excellence. I teach a handful of courses with a couple of great guys, Eric Jaconis out of St. Augustine and Jason London. out of Bozeman, Montana. He's a clinician out there, great sports clinician out west. And so I teach with those guys, and then I've also recently become faculty for Evidence in Motion. Tim Flynn and I got together and put together a few thrust-specific courses, so I'll be teaching thrust manipulation through EIM. We're going to launch that here over the next month or two. So between those two things, Gene, doing quite a few weekend courses sort of throughout the country, a lot of my own ones here in the upper Midwest, and just making it happen in the clinic about 45, 50 hours a week. So that's sort of my daily grind, as you put it. As far as mentorship, Gene, we take 4 to 5 DPT students a year. We're also a preferred residency site in Motion, and then starting next year, I'll be mentoring fellows in the clinic as well. So teaching is every bit as big a part of my job as the clinical side, but one can't go on well without the other. So they both kind of make each other happen.
Well, you don't have anything going on, do you?
No, it's pretty simple, really.
Slacker. Yeah. Let's get back to mentoring a little bit. Ersin, you recently just got back from a mentoring week, right? You were in Pennsylvania, I believe, and you were helping a clinic or clinician mentor. What do you see as, let's say, somebody gets out of school? How important is it, and what have you learned in terms of continuing the mentorship process beyond what we typically think of mentorship as in the school or just in residency?
Well, I think anyone who really wants to excel needs a mentor. And, you know, the concept of entry level has probably never been more, you know, ill-defined, I think. We certainly go to school a lot longer these days, and, you know, with a doctor being entry level, but it basically makes you competent to get a certain handful of patients better. And that's also entirely dependent on how great your clinical affiliations were. So, you know, anytime you can go to the best course in the world from the best instructor, the most charismatic instructor who really gets a point across, and you can learn all these winning evidence-based assessments and treatments. But unless you really have someone to bounce it off of, they don't necessarily need to be in clinic. They don't necessarily need to be with you in person. They could be online, but, you know, preferably it would be in person. Maybe you can meet with them at their clinic, or maybe they can come to your clinic. But a mentor is really essential for you to kind of foster your clinical decision-making, and they can teach you what they've learned based on their experience, which is kind of, you know, adapting from mistakes, which I always talk about why experience is so important, because you learn from your mistakes. So, you know, I think that everyone really needs a clinical mentor, and if you want to start your own practice, a business-based mentor like Joe.
Speaking of Joe, good transition. Joe, when you get new students, when you get new grads, how important is that mentorship to get them not only up to speed, but comfortable into the culture of the clinic?
I think it's hugely important. I think it's something that everybody coming out of school, that's what they want. They want to find a company that's not just going to use them as a clinician, but develop them as a clinician. I think that there's a huge difference. And I think just because you have your license in that state, and you know, by the books, you're ready to see patients and bill for treatments, that there's still a level of hesitancy. There's still a level of dependency that a new grad comes out with, and to really get them started and have them enjoy the first year of their professional life, I think is a huge responsibility on the company. And I think that those companies that take that seriously have employees that stick around for longer, and ultimately that trickles down to providing a better patient experience as well. So,
and that's having a really good understanding of who the clinicians are, like the millennial generation, right? It's really knowing how to guide them and how to do the mentoring without just pushing your agenda on them. It's really a back and forth. Like, I think I mentioned this in previous episodes. Like, when I came out of school that first year, you know, I thought I was I was the best thing in the world. I was so confident, and I was the best clinician. I was, I could do anything, and I felt great. And then until, years two and three come around, when you really realize that I was just a cocky prick and was just trying to show that I can do it because I wanted to prove my value. And having a mentor that is flexible and understands that and is willing to show you but still give you a little bit of rope is super important. And Jeff, I'm sure you and I have next week a Q&A coming up with some DPT students and new grads, which I'll tell you the number at the end that we already have signed up with a week to go. We might have to find a different way to have it. But I'm sure one of the questions that's going to come up is, how do you define or how do you figure out if a clinic is actually going to follow through on what they say? How do you differentiate a good mentor from a poor mentor?
You know, Gene, there's two things you could do right up front. And number one is to talk to those who went through the mentoring before you. So, I mean, any clinic, I would have folks say, can I talk to some clinicians who've been on board for a year or two and just sort of go out to lunch with them and say, guys, how much investment did these folks have in your development? You know, when things really got busy and it can get really easy for things to go by the wayside, how much did they focus and stay strict to their systems and make sure they developed you as a clinician? You know, one rule we have at my clinic, guys, is that, we just hired a new therapist just recently, Dr. Kristen Heierman. She's been wonderful. And one thing we have is if she does an eval on a patient, she has to sit with me for 20 minutes prior of that patient being seen a second time to make sure she's totally organized in the way she's thinking about the patient, how she's going forward, what she's looking at. And she has reported that to be just a wonderful way for her to go into that second visit feeling so much more organized than she was previously. So, clinics that are serious about mentoring should have these types of systems put into place. And I think the second one, Gene, would be to ask to sit in on one of their group get-togethers. And I think if they tell you we don't have group get-togethers, that should be a red flag right away. And if they do have once a month, once every 3 weeks, where they sit down and do journal reviews as a group and make sure they're getting on the same page, I think seeing the group dynamic and how they bounce off each other can just speak volumes about how seriously are these people devoted to learning to and from each other. And so I think those two routes can give you a real good feel on what you're looking at.
So then when a student, let's say, signs up and you begin the mentorship process, Joe, what does that actually entail? Like how do you set up your clinic to mentor? Because you have a new grad, right? Someone that is fairly, most of our listeners, especially DPT students, will know is Brooke McIntosh. She works at Active Life and Sport now. And she's said many times that she's having a great experience and she's learning a lot.
She's doing great.
That's what I've heard. I didn't know if that was the truth or not, but it's good to know that it is. How do you maintain that? How do you keep them engaged? How do you still challenge them? Because you don't want to just solve all their answers for them or their questions and give them everything on the silver platter. You still want them to have those experiences where they have to work and have to really go beyond their comfort zone. But how do you find that the medium between enough versus too much?
Right. So we do a few things. Let's first start by saying that the ramp up process it needs to be organized and it needs to be slow. So what we do at Active Life is we have her co-treat an initial evaluation on every body part. And not every diagnosis, but every body part. She's co-treating a neck before she's seeing a neck on her own. She's co-treating a knee before she's seeing a knee on her own. And that does a couple things. One, it gets her used to working with another member of our staff. And it also gives her time to work with the documentation system. And there's a little bit less pressure in the room. She doesn't have to carry the whole conversation, but she can. Then as she gets more comfortable, she starts takes those patients and she starts doing their follow-ups. And so she's not. She's been with us for a month, and she's still not at a full caseload, because we don't want her to be at a full caseload. She could be, and that's, I think, where some people fall off. As soon as they get busy, they lose their restraint to holding back on loading that new grad up. And I think it's important to stick with that. If that's your mindset, that you're going to bring them on slow, you need to stick with it, even when the rest of the schedule gets full. And then the other thing that we do is that I sit down with her once a week, every Tuesday. And, we go through any, cases that she's struggling with, and we go through any techniques that she wants to practice at, you know, in that time. So we have a set time every week where she can just chat about anything that's going on in that last week. So I do like Jeff's idea about taking time after each evaluation and making sure that she's got a good plan of care ready to go. But right now that's our method is meeting every week. So,
and that's pretty good. And then, you know, new grads there, especially the ones that we interact with a lot, like on Twitter and social media, they're very passionate. But they're also very driven, and they want to learn a lot, and in more than one way. You know, before it was, I want to learn this skill, I want to know how to manipulate that, when can I do dry needling, can we do more exercises, which is great. That's a good mentality to have, to learn more of the skill set. But nowadays it's also a lot want to know about business, they want to know about marketing, they want to know how to drive forward in the financial aspect of it as well. Urson, how do you tackle that for maybe more seasoned clinicians or newer grads that want mentoring, but also want kind of that social media aspect as well? Do you tackle that as well, or do you just keep it solely towards the clinical side?
Well, basically, I mean, people view me as some kind of social media expert, but I've just been doing that for, you know, 4 or 5 years now, and I read a lot on social media, but a lot of it was just kind of experimenting and see what stuck and what post got the most engagement. So yeah, if people want mentoring on that, I'm happy to help them. But in general, a lot of my mentoring has shifted from in my clinic, since I work less clinic hours, to either going to someone's clinic or just doing it online. And doing it online, often the first couple sessions I'll probably, it would just be a little bit of a Q&A just to get to kind of know the mentee a little bit. And then I'll do some lectures based on pain science and how I kind of take the eclectic approach and you know, the background in that. And then we just do cases back and forth. And there's actually a one mentee that I have in New York City who actually, we do cases simultaneously via Google Hangouts. So he actually brings the case to me, and, you know, we kind of tackle it together. And I think that's very useful for him to see what my thought process may be on patients he's kind of having difficulty with. So that's kind of my role as a mentor now. But because, again, I don't have as many clinical hours to kind of mentor someone in my clinic like I did for over a decade mentoring fellow candidates.
I think that's a interesting point, in that obviously you're kind of at a different stage of mentoring, but that kind of gets me thinking about challenges. So you go through stages, right? You have a protocol or progression, essentially, like Joe was saying, with their new grads or new hires. Jeff, what I want to know, or interested in, how do you, let's say you're, what was the name of the person you just hired?
Kristen.
So let's say Kristen is a year past and you've taught her kind of the foundation of the clinic and she's got it down and she's killing it. How do you progress? How do you challenge and take them to the next level? Now, you said you teach some EIM courses now, like, but how do you incorporate the next level? How do you keep them engaged in the learning process?
Yeah, Gene. So after you get past that first year and that clinical reasoning is becoming sound and you're needing less and less assistance to kind of get your mindset going forward, what we do then, you get more incorporated in more of our 3 week to monthly meetings where we bring in our most challenging cases and we lay them out and we say, okay, why isn't, you know, we use photo in the clinic. And so we take a patient who's not budging functionally and we say, guys, what are we missing? So let's all start thinking out of the box now. What data didn't we gather? What aren't we seeing? And you start getting engaged in this sort of group dynamic of all of us searching for the missing link. And so doing that on a regular basis is definitely next level type of reasoning.
And once you come to a solution, is it become a co-treatment? Is it you just they go in and try what you discussed? How much time do you give it before you come back and reconvene?
Yeah, so usually it just stays with the therapist that, you know, any therapist might bring a challenging case to the table, or I might recognize a photo score that isn't doing well and ask if that case is brought to the table. And then once we have our powwow, that clinician will go back with that patient with that new frame of reference, and then at our next monthly session, they'll report how the change has affected the treatment.
And you do, technique-wise, if we can break it down, you do, if you're teaching IM, obviously, doing manipulations, right?
Yeah, so primarily my weekend teaching is on thrust manipulation and clinical reasoning. Yeah.
So how do you teach? Because one of the hardest things is not teaching the technique. That's fairly easy to teach, not easy to perfect, but easy to teach. How about the differential diagnosis, the clinical reasoning? How do you really break that down for them? Because a lot of times you have to be in the moment. You have to pick up, you have to learn how to interview somebody and understand the symptoms and guide that interview process. How do you mentor somebody in that?
Yeah, so you know, you always start on that first door, right? So when they're first starting, you look at those real small windows. You use your CPR studies, you use Tim stuff, you use Louis stuff, you use Cleland stuff, and you say, hey, these are spots where unless you have a contraindication, you're probably going to try this, you know, but and then it moves from there, you know, and when in doubt, don't. And as your confidence progresses, you start using different levels of reasoning. And so you start shaving down that original lumbar CPR to Fritz's modification with just a less than 16 days and pain below the knee. And you keep getting grayer and grayer as you're having this discussion until you're starting to see the nuances, you know, and you start moving beyond just the published literature and you start factoring in patient preferences, right? You start thinking about these other areas that might shift your reasoning one way or the other. And those just become good discussions on a case-by-case basis. But as I think you guys would all agree, it really comes down to solid clinical reasoning. You know, ruling out the areas that isn't, you know, really trial treating your hypothesis and confirming you're in the right area, knowing the patient's irritability, you know, what are appropriate treatments, what does the patient want to receive, what has worked historically, and starting to have these discussions with every patient until they build that nuanced skill set that allows them to know when to do what.
And then once they get proficient in differential diagnosis, and there's a lot of different ways to process it, right? So you with the manipulations, it's a little bit of a biomechanical approach, or the CPRs. And then Urson, you have kind of the MDT approach. How do you go between the two and without having new grads' heads exploding?
This episode of Therapy Insiders is sponsored by WebPT. As we mentioned, the ultimate EMR for physical therapists. But what makes them the ultimate EMR, I'm sure you're wondering? I decided to ask Anne, a longtime user of WebPT. Here's what she had to say.
I really like the fact that I can send my notes right through WebPT. I can fax them to physicians so that they can see the plan of care and sign it and send it back. My logo is on everything that I send out, and it's all legible. So it really saves me a lot of time in the end because I don't have calls back from either insurance companies or attorneys if it's, you know, a car accident, things like that, asking me to interpret my handwriting on anything.
WebPT, the ultimate EMR for physical therapists, because it's more than just notes. Check them out at 866-221-1870 for a free demo, or webpt.com/podcast.
Well, I think I talk a lot about what Jeff is talking about too, because I like CPRs for what they are, and I think they help you identify a patient population that is more readily they're going to improve more rapidly than another population. And it's more predictive of clinical success rather than telling you what exactly is wrong with the patient. So, you know, big in the patient classification rather than diagnoses, because, you know, certain research shows that if you classify a patient, it helps kind of enhance your clinical decision making versus kind of spending time trying to rule in and out certain diagnoses. You still may do the same exercises and manual therapies. But I'm big into patient preference as well. And you know, I think MDT kind of fits in with that. What modern guidelines basically say is that you should be empowering the patient and using less passive therapies and more active therapies. And even if you use passive therapies, it's kind of to make the patient more able to do their home exercise program, which ultimately is kind of what crystallizes their improvements, not necessarily the transient effects of a manual therapy.
Yeah, I think that's, I've always been, well, from the get-go, because that's my mentorship, my training has been on the biomechanical side of it. So, you know, just this is the problem, fix the problem, move on to something else. But the more I did kind of studying on my own and researching it, I've really got into the neurophysiological aspects of it, which I think work really well. But to me, I feel like the best clinicians are the eclectic ones, and not to play off of your eclectic approach, but I think it's true. It's the more you can combine of different perspectives, and I don't know about you guys, but I get asked this question a lot, which kind of, I don't know, maybe unjustly annoys me, but I get asked all the time, well, who do you do? You know, which technique, which school do you follow? It's like, I learn from the best, and I take the best from the best and make it my own. And kind of combine it, because the more you know, the more approaches you have, you don't have to blindly follow any single approach. You know, you don't have to be Mulligan, or you don't have to be Paris or any of those people. You learn because there's some really cool stuff, and then you kind of combine your own thing, and that's the whole point of being a clinician, right? Is you figure these things out versus just getting into a routine and going on autopilot, because once you're on autopilot, I don't think your job is very fun anymore. You're just kind of going through the motions, which can also happen. So when you do get on the autopilot, Joe, how do you bust out of something like that?
Well, I think new people help you bust out of something like that. If we want to bring it back to mentorship, you can learn from your mentees. I mean, you you should. So, you know, I think that, teaching somebody something new and then learning the way they learned how to do it and kind of talking about different styles and approaches is all part of the learning process. So, I mean, I learn things every time anybody new starts at our office. So as long as you're open to that, then you're going to continue to grow. But, you know, I wanted to go touch back on what you said about, you know, what technique, you know, who do you use? You know, you use the techniques that are going to work for that patient. And so I think that if you're not open to doing different techniques and different approaches, then your narrow vision may narrow your scope of who you successfully treat. Just because I think that the patient preferences and beliefs play a large role in their overall recovery.
Yeah, I often talk about that too, because people are like, oh, do you recommend, I mean, at least weekly, like, oh, you trained with Paris and you trained with McKenzie, which would you recommend? And it's like, well, usually I recommend the one that, you know, you're weakest at, but I don't really recommend gurus. I kind of recommend clinical decision making. And like everyone's been saying, patient preference and what has worked for them in the past, if you ignore that, then I think you're really not going to get a certain amount of patients better. And, you know, I think faculty of a lot of these different institutes like PRI and, you know, McKenzie, and they may have blinders on, but they also have a huge amount of placebo and charisma and practice with wording the way they go through assessments and the way they educate their patients. And I think that very few people, clinicians, will be able to have the same success that a particular faculty member has in their one approach. So I think the what works for most clinicians is to be eclectic, and not necessarily my approach, but just taking bits and pieces of what works for them and the things that you can explain best and utilize best and kind of sell the most, but also have enough to kind of cater to everyone's tastes and preferences.
I think you nailed it there. I think it's the selling. I think it's one thing you don't learn. You can learn all the techniques in the world, but if you don't learn how to properly communicate with the people, it's never going to be successful. Having that conversation with them, having them buy in into what you're doing, how you're doing it, and why you're doing it, and them to fully trust and be on board will get you better outcomes than having the best technique in the world. And I know that's one big thing that, I don't know, I'm sure you guys are the same way. I'd get a lot of patients of, oh yeah, I went to 3 other PTs and it didn't work. So you were recommended to me and I don't think it's going to work either. And kind of talking through them before doing anything and finding out what was going on and what they did and setting yourself up for success through communication will, in my opinion, and Jeff, you could let me know if your outcome data suggests this, set yourself up for better outcomes.
Yeah, Gene. I mean, I like both the discussions we're having right now. I mean, I love that you guys covered. I think the guru-based approach is the new modality-based approach. You know, it's kind of when you step up and say, I'm a McKenzie therapist, it kind of reveals, you know, what it used to reveal 10 years ago when you said, you know, you were the ultrasound. You know, it just shows you're a bit behind the curve. I hope we've moved past that. And I mean, we're what? Delito was what, 95, 96? And we've been looking at using, you know, appropriate interventions that might indicate, you know, a certain subgroup is going to respond to it for almost 20 years. And the fact that we're still sort of stuck in this guru-based approach in some sets is surprising and a bit disappointing. But to your second comment, Gene, the therapeutic alliance is where it's at, man. I mean, that patient comes in, they're frustrated, you know, like, God, now my doc sent me over here. My wife told me I had to go here because you had some success with other folks. And, you know, I'm not feeling it. If you sit that person down and say, you know, what aren't you feeling? You know, what aren't you feeling? What happened at the other places? You know, what do you think you need that you haven't gotten yet? When you start engaging, you know, and Urson's touched on it and Joe's touched on it, when you start engaging into their expectations, engaging to really meeting them where they are, that's an entirely different therapeutic experience than trying your quote unquote approach on this individual. And I just love that you're going that direction.
And it has to be, because they are your customer, right? If somebody came in to the Apple store, which has a really high reputation and everyone loves Apple iPhones, right, Arsene? Right, exactly. So if you walk in there and you had a first generation iPod Touch once in a while that would die on you after a while, and you go, man, yeah, I don't think I'm going to like the iPhone. Everyone keeps telling me it's great, but my iPod, you know, is a piece of crap. It's not the same thing. You have to show them why the iPhone is great and kind of recharge or reset their expectation, because that's what you're always dealing with. You're always working with a new set of expectations. And the better you are at explaining those expectations and getting somebody ready to get better, that's the way it works, because that's the only way you can get somebody better is when they're ready to do it. You can't help somebody that's not ready to be helped.
Oh, exactly, man. I mean, and if you walk in already knowing in your head what approach, so to speak, you intend to try, I think that's really a misguided way to approach things. I mean, the only way you want to walk in is to try to see if you can understand the individual. And then once you do you have something in your arsenal that might be able to bump them forward, you know, and have really no preconceived notions on what that might be.
So let's cover some quick techniques that we use, some strategies that we use to break in communication. So let's do a pseudo mentoring session. Let's say that we are going to teach one of our new grads or a mentee, might not be a new grad, how we like to either break the ice or just get somebody really relaxed in that first evaluation. So let's start with Urson, since he's the oldest.
Okay, well, just because Jeff graduated a lot after me,
Well, Jeff has got a cool beard.
Maybe I'm a Doogie Howser, you know? We just go by graduation dates.
Well, you've actually called yourself out several times on this podcast.
Oh, Doogie Howser. What, you guys too young for Doogie Howser? Oh, my gosh. Doogie Howser? Who's that? He was a medical genius, people. Genius.
Who played Doogie Howser?
You may know him from Harold and Kumar.
What else?
NPH, Neil Patrick Harris. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. The other show, it's too new for me.
How I Met Your Mother?
Too new.
Too new. All right, old man. Go ahead.
Okay. What was the question?
And that pretty much summarized.
How do I start out a mentee?
How do you break the ice with a patient? What is your technique? What is your go-to if you have a curmudgeonous person that comes in? How do you get them to kind of relax and get into a better mindset?
Well, I think I basically try to form some sort of connection with them. I ask them what their story is, you know, and what typically if these people are in pain, I'm assuming we're not doing some kind of performance thing. And, you know, what is your pain story? Why do you think you have it? Why do you think, you know, what is it that about your pain that prevents you from doing the things in your life that you can't do? And when you start to hear the story and their beliefs and maybe some thought viruses that they kind of picked up along the way from other probably well-meaning practitioners that are kind of ill-informed with a more of a pain science approach, then you kind of get a lot of different talking points and educational points. And I try to just really kind of alleviate any anxiety and educate on any, you know, kind of myths that they have and about these perceptions about, you know, degeneration and what their MRI looks like and all this kind of bad news they just get from not only practitioners, but other people who they've spoken to and about how PT doesn't work and this isn't going to work. And, you know, so I try to get like different talking points. I just try to connect with them at some point. And I also try to find a motivation. You know, if they say they can't run or they can't hold their grandkids, and, you know, I really, it's like, hey, look, you know, let's just try this. And the research shows that if we get you moving in a certain direction or we get you to find a position of ease and your symptoms kind of improve dramatically within the first visit, and you're able to keep some of those improvements between the first and second visits, and the research shows that, you know, you'll probably do pretty well most of the time. And you kind of shift it toward, I'm going to fix you, to I'm going to show you how to manage this on your own, and you won't need me or anyone else. And I think if you can find someone's motivation, because most people have a motivation, and like Chad Cook said, as long as they're ready to get better, like on that readiness scale, then I think you'll eventually find it. You know, not everyone, you can't reach everyone, but I think if you really listen to them and you try to find motivation, you'll reach them.
I agree. What about you, Joe?
Before I go, let's touch on that. You can't save everybody, and sometimes I think that that's a thing for a new therapist coming out to really understand as well. If they're not ready, and they really are putting up a lot of barriers, there does come a point where they have to do their part. So helping our young therapists to understand that is important as well, because it's not their fault, and they can't internalize that as well. So just a side note there, but
it's a great point. Yeah.
when I start with a patient, I try to find out not only about what they're going through, what they've already tried. I know we touched on that. But what their perception of what they tried did for them or didn't do for them. I think you can learn a lot based on what they've already done. You don't want to do what they've already had done unless you really think that they got it from a bad source. You know, I try to come at them from a different approach because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for something that they haven't tried yet. So to give them that hope that this is going to be what the answer is. And I think that if you can start developing that, that trust by painting that picture of this is what we need to do, and kind of explaining to them in detail what your plan is confidently, I think that's one way to start to build that relationship.
Absolutely. What about you, Jeff?
Well, those are all just awesome points, and they're all such big pieces of the puzzle. You know, I agreed with Urson's earlier comment that you might use certain techniques to improve the neurophysiological status of a patient, maybe get a bit of pain reduction, maybe get a bit of positive vibes going on. But ultimately, the big key to the lock is going to be that home program and that empowering of the individual, which really speaks then to they have to be ready. I mean, if the most important piece of the puzzle is them doing stuff and not our passive intervention, their readiness is an essential piece to us moving forward. And so I really think that you have to have an honest discussion with them about, you know, are you ready for rehab? Are you in a good place right now to be doing rehab? And so, and I mean, I just think it needs to be had just like that, you know, and the patient appreciates that from so many perspectives. I mean, number one, you're clearly not trying to run them through a mill to make cash. I mean, you're saying, hey, if you want to walk out the door right now and that's where you need to be, that's where we should go, you know. And I think that just right off the bat really shifts the patient's perspective. And then leapfrogging off of Joe's comment and maybe adding a bit to it even is, you know, not doing what hasn't worked for them in the past. You know, and that's the problem with coming in with, quote unquote, your approach. And you saying to the patient, well, I know you didn't like having your neck cracked before, but I'm going to crack it different, you know, and that somehow is going to work. This generally, unless, as Joe said, they really got a certain care that you think you could improve upon, that generally isn't an awesome course of action. And then again, apparently I'm just going to copy these guys. But again, like Joe said, confidently, and I would say specifically explaining your plan. So I think patients really appreciate when they hear, hey, I'd like to see you a couple times a week over the next 3 weeks. And if we haven't seen something real significant, and it's even nicer than if you can use a specific issue they're having. You know, if we're not seeing you sleep through the night, you know, 6 out of the 7 days of the week, I think we've really got to reevaluate where we are. And so just confidently saying, here's what I'd like to do, and here's how I'd like to go about it, and what do you think? Is that something you would buy into? And then seeing if you can get them on board. So I just think all of those things are so crucial.
Jeff, that's a great point as far as the detail, and I think that can't stop at the initial evaluation. That we encourage our therapists to have that conversation as they progress, because I think that's what continues to keep the patient bought in. That there's something new next week, you know. And I know my plan, and I know my progression. I'm not gonna. I'm feeling a little bit better, yeah. But I'm not gonna stop because I know what's in store for me, and to have that conversation at subsequent visits, I think improves retention and follow through on the full plan.
That's such a great point, Joe. And my photo data, that's one thing I saw. You know, and I always talk to my staff about proving the value of another visit, right? Every time you see a patient, you have to prove the value to that patient of coming back again. You know, what, like you said, what is it we're going to do next? How is that going to help them? And then getting the patient to say, yeah, that sounds good. I'd like to come again. Every time you see a patient, you're proving the value of the next session. I think that's just really that higher level care. And when I started really incorporating that, that's when I saw a huge drop in no-show cancellation rate.
And that's the customer experience. You want them to look forward to coming to see you because they will expect something that will get them better. And I think that's where the big psychology piece plays into it. that is super important. So when I see a patient for the first time, I almost look at it as not an interview per se in terms of subjective, but like an interview like this, almost like a pitch in a business sense, that I want to control the narrative, and the narrative, I want it to be a story. And just like, you know, if you look at a lot of the psychology, people form an impression of you within 7 to 10 seconds. So they'll know whether they're going to like you or not. So you have 7 to 10 seconds to fine tune that intro. And with me is, my intro hardly ever starts with pain or anything to do with their dysfunction. And it's usually as simple as, hey, what's going on? Or, hey, what brings you in? Or, hey, how's it going? Nothing of, hey, what hurts? Or what haven't you been able to do? Or anything in that specific realm. I let the story start that way. And then you have to guide it within a story narrative. You know, if somebody comes in and says, my neck's been killing me. It's like a 2 out of 10. Do you guys ever get that? Like somebody just tells you a number because they've been through the gauntlet. Oh yeah, my pain's a 3 out of 10.
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
absolutely.
Then you get the people who actually can never objectively quantify it, but they just know they don't feel well, you know? So.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the time to start steering. When they say, oh, hey, yeah, my pain's a 2 out of 10. You're like, okay, that's great. That's a number. That's not your pain. Let's take a step back. Why don't you go back X amount of time? Let's start really thinking about some of the stuff that's been going on that might have caused some of this stuff, and just really take them away from that moment, from that number, and start dissociating from a number perspective, and really start getting them thinking like a person. What happened? What could they do? What couldn't they do? And you start really breaking it down that way. And again, that's when you start forming a story. Like, oh yeah, 5 years ago, I was doing this and this and that, kind of felt this, didn't think too much of it. Do you think it could have been that? And that's when you have them. That's when they start thinking like a person. That's when you're caught up in their story, and that's when they'll buy into you, because that's when they want to know what you think, and that's how you start helping them. And don't kid yourself. You're helping them. You're not fixing anything. If you're seeing somebody 3 days a week, you're seeing them 2% of the week, 3 hours. Let's say 3 hours out of 168 hours, 2%, which I think ties in everything else everyone's talked about, is you need that person to commit. Because if they're not ready, just seeing you 2% of the time is not going to do anything. They need to be ready to take it in their own hands at home. Right?
Right, Gene. No one else thinks Gene is right, but I think Gene is right.
I think Gene
is definitely right. Yeah.
When are you not right, Gene?
I don't know. Hey, that moment will happen at one
Gene's
point.
Gene's right again. Here we go.
hey, Jeff.
Yeah.
How do you set your therapist up to really sell that next visit, like you said? Do you guys practice scenarios like that? Do you have a certain plan that you kind of work them into? Do you mentor that?
Joe, I'm so glad you asked me, because as Kristen, she's probably laughing as the moment she hears that. So we just had that discussion. So that's my favorite part of the mentoring, Joe. So we have the eval, right? And she comes out and we set aside our 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and she really gives me the whole story, you know, from the subjective interview to the physical exam, her hypotheses, what she proved and disproved, her trial treatment. And then we have the finish, and it's always my favorite part. And I say, so Kristen, what did you tell him? And that is where the newer graduates have the hardest time. And it's so fun, because I can see myself, you know, 8, 9 years ago, bumbling through with that spine model and trying to explain to this poor patient their facet dysfunction, and just how you learn over time to adapt that to meet the patient where they are, and to explain that, you know, hey, there's nothing serious going on here. Just so glad to see all your nerves were intact. Everything looks great. You've got some mechanical back pain. We're going to get you moving. And just having them tell you what they told their patient, and then tell them what you would have told their patient, and you just see the light go on a little more every time. And every time they tell you their explanation, it's a little smoother. It has a little bit less damaging language. It's a little more optimistic. And so, Joe, that's my – I got a little long-winded there, but that's my favorite part is at the end saying, so how did you convey your findings and explain your path forward? And then us really working on fine-tuning that.
I think that's a great way to do it. And so does that carry over with subsequent visits as well? You're on their program, kind of working with what they're gonna entice them with next to bring them back.
Yeah, Joe, albeit a bit looser. You know, it becomes every couple visits. Hey, are you still moving forward? Do you know why you're moving forward? Does the patient know why you're moving forward? There's still those questions, Joe. It's not nearly as structured as it is after the initial eval. How about you guys?
It's honestly, it's something that we need to do better. We don't have a structure for mentoring that, and that's why I asked the question. I think it is important. It's something that I do and encourage. But as you know, when encouragement doesn't get it done, you need to have a structure in place.
Absolutely. I think structure until you don't need the structure anymore. And it's kind of to do an analogy to runners, when training runners, is they come in with their technique and running style, you teach them a different way and you structure it as much as you can, but then eventually they kind of fuse and combine the two, and you need to let them do that. And I think it's the same thing when mentoring. You have to let them figure out a middle ground of what you teach and what they've had before and create their new medium. All right, so to finish up a little bit, I think this is a great amount of information and covered a lot of topics. Let's close out. Any final thoughts / recommendations for new grads looking for mentorship? Start with our guest, Jeff.
You know, I'm going to go with the quote of the night. I loved how Joe said, you're looking for a clinic that isn't just looking to use you as a clinician, but is looking to develop you as a clinician. I love the way you said that. And I think there's a lot of ways you can go about finding that out. Some of them we already discussed, but that's exactly what you're looking for. In when you're having conversations with clinic owners, clinic managers, you want to get a feel for, are they looking to use me as a clinician, or are they looking to develop me as a clinician? In that, you want that right in the front of your radar.
Great points. Urs?
Well, I can say that I wish that as a new grad, I wish that I had worked at either one of your clinics, because, man, I mean, when I was my final clinical, the first thing they asked me was, can you do evals? And I was just doing like 20 evals a week, including the dreaded Friday night 7 p.m. eval that only showed up once a month, you know, and the guy made me stay the entire time, even though he knew it wasn't going to show up. Like, he'd be playing solitaire, and I would just be like, this eval is not going to show up. It's like 7:58. Can I go? And I was like, no. What if he walks in now? I'm like, who walks in now? I'm not going to do this eval. So, yeah. new grads and students are very fortunate to work at both your clinicals. I think fostering the clinical decision-making process is the most important thing. And as a new grad or even a novice therapist, I think you guys should not be looking for the latest and greatest treatment, but you should be looking for, mentors that will tell you what to do with a treatment or when to use this treatment on a certain patient and how much treatment someone needs and whether you're over-treating or under-treating. And that you could only learn from someone who's learned that from experience. So I think that, again, it doesn't need to be live, could be online. It could be someone you just shadow it. And I think that that's very, very valuable. So those are my thoughts.
True. What about you, Joe?
I'm going to go with what Jeff said earlier, which is ask a therapist that's been at the place that you're looking to go, because and shadow. You know, there's no better opportunity than when you're just coming out of school to ask clinics to shadow for a couple of days. If they don't want to let you talk to the staff or shadow, then they're not the right place for you, no matter what they're offering. Because to me that throws up a red flag that they're trying to hide something. And they can say whatever they want to say. You know, the proof is in the pudding, and that's talking to the people that are living it right now and working for them. So I think if that's the one thing you take away from this is to do your due diligence and really spend some time making that first decision. I think that's the best thing that you can do.
Definitely. And don't forget, and a lot of our listeners already know this, but you have so many resources outside from your little box in the clinic. And we talk about and proponent social media all the time, but seriously, you need to get on and be part of the conversation, because the conversation's going to happen whether you're there or not, but you have a chance to be part of it. It doesn't matter if you have zero followers or you have a million followers, especially on Twitter. People interact and people engage, and we're more than happy to give advice if asked, whether mentorship or not. So, Jeff, man, thank you so much for joining us. You and I have that Q&A with new grads and DPT students on July 29th to kind of date this podcast a little bit. So we're going to have a little bit more chatting to do. But thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was just great listening and learning from you guys. Enjoyed it.
Really appreciate it. So we promised a little information on UpDoc Media, and that is we are going to be launching within the next week or so with four podcasts, one being Therapy Insiders, two being a business-centered podcast called Business, Bourbon, and Baseball with Jerry Durham. You might know the name. He's been on the podcast a few times. Shout out. Third podcast. It's called Running Story with Amanda Loudon. And Amanda has a huge blog right now called MissZippy1.com. And she talks about running in a lot of aspects. And she writes for a lot of magazines. And she's a really avid runner herself. But this podcast is going to talk about the story of running, how running affects and changes people's lives. Because it's important for a lot of people as an outlet and in a lot of ways. And the fourth podcast is called The Strength Doc with Dr. John Russin, who's been on this podcast. And John himself has a really, really awesome following and writes about some really cool stuff in a lot of magazines. And you can check him out on his site, drjohnrussin.com. So that's your little tidbit on UpDoc Media launching really, really soon, not to mention all the blogging and some webinars that will be coming out as well. So check it out. We'll let you know when that's out, but very, very soon. And the personal bit of information that we had kind of teased in the beginning is I recently resigned from my clinic and will be focusing all my attention on this and UpDoc Media and growing the podcast and doing some of the mentoring like with Jeff for the students and kind of building some entrepreneur programs for anybody that's interested. And also the Verve, which is the ARC, the little device that my partner and I developed, created, and are selling on Amazon. So a new journey for me, but still in this realm, right?
Right. Nothing like a little pressure to get an entrepreneur driven.
That's right. And it was great. It was fun. I love being in the clinic 40 hours, but 40 hours in the clinic plus another 50 hours doing other stuff doesn't necessarily always create the best environment, but 6 months was enough of that. So you'll be seeing a lot of cool stuff coming your way from us. We're always available at the OMPT, which is Urson on Twitter, at Joe DPT on Twitter, at Therapy Insiders. And Jeff, what's your Twitter handle? What can people find you? Twitter, email, anything?
Yeah, my Twitter is at JeffMooreDPT, and my email is JeffMooreDPT@gmail.com.
So there you go. If you have any questions for any of us, please let us know. Send us an email. Same, you know, we say it every week, but it's true every week. The emails that we get from you guys and gals are awesome. Words of encouragement, questions, they're great. We love it. Please check us out on iTunes. Leave us a review. Those reviews really help us stay up on the charts. And we'll post very, very soon some little tidbits from UpDoc Medium. So again, thank you to our guest, Jeff Moore. And we'll catch you guys next time.
Thanks, Gene.